you know.
The Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Morning, members. Morning, Mr. Sal. You're going to begin the presentation today. We have the whole committee set aside for the court to present its budget. And I know that you have witnesses here that can provide testimony to your request. So with that, if you'd like to proceed and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the division, my name is Sue Dosal. I am the State Court Administrator. And I'm here today, along with a number of other people, to present the court's budget for this coming biennium. As you know, the judiciary is a core function of government, provided for in the Constitution as one of three coequal branches of government, to charge with protecting the individual rights of our citizens that are set out in Article 1, Minnesota's Bill of Rights. And that includes the constitutional guarantee that all disputes, both civil and criminal, be handled promptly and without delay. And that is the mission on which our budget request for this coming biennium is based. Now, a few facts. We have 3,000 employees, 300 judges operating in 100 locations across the state. So in terms of pure geographic reach, the judiciary touches more Minnesota citizens than virtually any other state department or agency. We handle 2 million cases a year. Base budget about $281 million, and we collect $191 million in revenue that goes back to the state general fund, a number of state dedicated funds, and to county and city government. And the green in your packet, the green sheet on the right-hand side, just kind of details that revenue for you. As members of the committee know, we recently completed our 15-year journey to transferring the funding responsibility of the trial courts from the counties to the state. So this is the first year that the entire judicial branch will be state-funded, and the first biennium when our operating budget faded rests entirely with you. The judicial branch appropriation is divided into three separate budgets, one for each level of court, as indicated here. And our change level requests for this coming biennium are in these five categories listed on the slide. Our intention is to cover the strategic initiatives and legally mandated services today and wrap up with the other three tomorrow morning. So starting with the strategic initiative, our first category of request, our Judicial Council, which is the new governing body for the judicial branch since state funding, has recently adopted a strategic plan for the branch for the next 2 years, which focuses on access to justice, effectiveness, and accountability. And those are our three overarching goals. Underneath each of those are a number of initiatives that we intend to undertake in order to accomplish those goals. Seven of them we are internally funding, and three of them we are asking for new funding for. And these are the three that are listed on this slide. The first of those is a request for a phase one of a multi-year drug court initiative. Now, this request comes out of the work of a multidisciplinary Supreme Court Chemical Dependency Task Force, which studied this issue of AOD, that's alcohol and other drugs, that's the acronym that we use, AOD, very intensively for 18 months. And at the end of that, called for a broad and fundamental shift in how we are dealing with AOD offenders, because what we are doing now does not work. Now, we know that AOD is a pervasive factor in Minnesota. We have some 33,000 DWI arrests each year. Many are repeat offenders. One in nine of our licensed drivers have a DWI on their record. AOD is a factor in 80% of our criminal cases. It impacts juvenile delinquency, child protection, family cases, and others as well. Drug cases increased by nearly 70% over this five-year period. We know that meth is a very significant contributor to this problem. And just recently, in this last year, we've seen a surge in DWI cases as well. Now, nationally, we know that relapse and recidivism rates are very high for AOD offenders who are simply sent to prison. 30% of them in a 1998 national study, 30% of these offenders released from prison were rearrested within 6 years, nearly 70% within 3 years, and nearly all returned to AOD use soon after their release. Now, recently we have discovered more effective approaches to AOD offenders both here in Minnesota and nationwide. And these are drug courts and what we call problem-solving strategies. A drug court uses the coercive power of the court in collaboration with the other justice system stakeholders to closely monitor drug court offenders toward sobriety and recovery through frequent drug testing, ongoing treatment, regular court check-ins, and the use of immediate sanctions and incentives to get them on their way toward recovery. Drug courts are designed to provide greater offender oversight and public safety. They emphasize treatment and rehabilitation with the use of sanctions and incentives and restore offenders to law-abiding lives. Now, these are some of the benefits of drug courts. They improve outcomes for AOD offenders by enhancing their chances for long-term sobriety and recovery and their overall social functioning. So that's how they reduce recidivism and therefore avoid both future criminal justice costs and costs to other victims in the future. Now, this slide is why nationally drug courts have grown from the first one, which was in Miami, Dade County in 1989, to over 1,900 today. Well, Minnesota is definitely behind the curve in terms of drug courts. We have only two drug courts that have been operating for more than 5 years, and most of our drug courts have gotten started in just the last 2 years. Currently, we have 19 operating offender drug courts, and those are located in the counties with the pink on the slide. And many of them got started with one-time federal grants, and a number of them got started with the appropriations from the legislature that were approved just in this current biennium. Now, what I'd like to do is to give you some real-life experience with drug courts and their successes, and I'd like to call on Judge Robert Rancourt from Chisago County, as well as two of the members of his team, County Commissioner Lynn Schultz and Bonnie Vader, who is an education liaison, and if they would come forward.
Mr. Saul, I have a question as they're coming up. On one of the slides on the drug court outcomes, just so you can help us understand this, I think a lot of us support what you're trying to do, and I'm eager to hear from the testifiers, but the slide about outcomes, when you show New York and California and Washington, decreases in recidivism, a $250 million savings 3 years following arrest, are those savings system-wide, or are they from the Department of Corrections? Have you computed that? I mean, if we were to say that we have the $7 million, I think that's your request, for 8 drug courts in Minnesota, that we could save a couple of $100 million. Would we find $100 million in savings in the Department of Corrections budget?
I think the savings, Mr. Chairman and members, are in both the county, at the county level, and jail avoidance beds and the recidivism costs. They also are at the corrections level in terms of avoided prison beds. I mean, many of these are individuals that are being handled by drug courts are presumptive commits. And so some of it will be there. Some of them would be departures. We have a high departure rate, as you know, in Minnesota. So some of them would remain within the county. But we do have some evidence that there are beds, county beds saved, as well as what we think is will be savings at the state level as well. So we think it's both. I do think there needs to be an investment up front before these savings occur. And, of course, that's always the challenge, isn't it?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sal. And for the individuals who are testifying, we're taping the this meeting. So if you could please introduce yourself for the record, and as for taping purposes, if you could go through the chair, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Judge Robert Rancourt. I'm a judge in Chisago County, which is about 45 minutes northeast of St. Paul. It's part of the 10th District. We started a juvenile drug court approximately in December of 2004. And as Ms. LaSalle indicates, there are currently over 1,900 drug court operations in the United States, and Minnesota has about 19. And it is clear that drug courts and drug court principals are becoming institutionalized as a way of doing business in the courts throughout the country. And the reasons for that are quite clear. Recent statistics by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, show that the state of Minnesota currently ranks third in the country for those individuals between the ages of 18 to 20 who state they used methamphetamine in the past year. That's not a good statistic. But that's what we're addressing in this particular state at this time. We're third in the country. Of the 8,300 individuals currently in prison in Minnesota, 90% were diagnosed as chemically dependent or chemically abusive. So you can see what we see as judges on a daily basis in the court. Not only as criminal offenders come before the court, juvenile offenders and families coming into our child protection system. It's pervasive. Alcohol and other drugs are pervasive throughout all of those areas, including domestic abuse cases and family violence. It's pervasive. As I've indicated, 90% were diagnosed as chemically dependent in the prison system. 60% of all offenders need primary treatment, and out of those, 65% of those don't get it. So we have to do something new. The U.S. Government Accountability Office had a study in February of 2005 in a report where they did an extensive review of drug court research, which showed that most adult drug court programs evidenced lower rearrest and conviction rates for drug court participants than comparison groups, as Mr. Sell has indicated. The General Accounting Office used a cost-benefit analysis, and that's eventually, I think, what the state is attempting to do as well through evaluations that are tied to each of these drug courts so we know if these drug courts are working from a cost-benefit standpoint. But again, they determine the costs associated with implementing or operating a program and weighing that cost against any benefits experienced from the program. The results of a cost-benefit analysis can be reported as either a net benefit, and that's calculated as total benefits minus total costs, or a benefit-to-cost ratio calculated as total benefits divided by total cost. And the GAO in its study used a net benefit analysis. And the results showed, of the drug courts that they studied, showed a net benefit up to $15,000 per participant. This analysis primarily related to reductions in recidivism. And that's grossly underestimated, if you will, or understated in drug courts because they did not include indirect benefits such as reduced benefit medical costs, as the chair has spoken of, increased worker productivity. Reductions in recidivism can lead to benefits or cost savings for criminal justice agencies and for potential victims of crime. A reduction in the number of arrests will result in a reduction of expenditures for the agencies, including police, prosecution, courts, corrections departments, and probation agencies. Potential victims benefit from reduced recidivism, meaning costs such as lost property values, medical expenses, quality of life costs relating to pain and suffering. It benefits the society as a result of reduction in substance abuse, avoiding medical costs such as medical services a treated drug addict would require. Labor market outcome may improve because they're employable. money that they can pay taxes, which will be benefit society in general. They won't be a debt, if you will. It'll be an income-producing individual for society. Reduce homelessness, reduce child welfare costs, delay parenting for juveniles, and improve school attendance and high school graduation rates. That's what we're attempting to do in the courts at this time, is to change what we've seen in the past. And that's the continuing recycling of families and individuals that come through our courts. I would like to share a letter, we have limited time, from one of our drug court graduates in Chisago County. This was a young lady who was severe methamphetamine addiction. And I remember seeing her on my regular juvenile calendar one time, on a detention calendar, coming out of the holding cell. She's totally disheveled, looked just horrible. And I remember telling this girl, I'm not going to give up on you. And I remember her looking back at me and saying, I'm not going to give up on you either. And I didn't know what that meant. But in any event, this is the letter that she had wrote to the drug court after graduation. She says, I've been in drug court for about 2 years now. I have that time. I have now been sober for 6 months. And she has a little happy face. And I feel very confident that I will continue to stay sober after I leave drug court. I have a very good support system from my family, Barb, and my really sweet friends. I'm also planning on keeping my sponsor. My teachers at school are really supportive and always willing to help me out. This school year started off a little rocky because I did not have all the resources that I needed. But that is all taken care of now, and I am caught up in school. So far, my basic plans for the future are to move in with my sister at the end of the month and finding a good job. I'm also very excited to finish school because I found out that I am right on track. And I plan to do all of this without any chemicals. My life prior to drug court was like a roller coaster. There was frequent mood swings and tones of drama. I don't think that I was ever really happy. Now today, after drug court, I have had a job, am in school and doing good. I talk to my family, I have hobbies and really great friends. But most of all, I can walk down the street with my head held high and truly smile with real happiness and know that I'm going to be okay. The thing that I would have to say I am most grateful from drug court is that they helped me to get a relationship back with my dad, which is something that was really eating at me. So I thank you guys for that because it has helped me in more ways than you guys could ever know. Now that I am sober, my relationships are much better because they're real and not false ones. That is a common theme for most drug court graduates and families that come before our courts when they do go through a program such as a drug court. George Bernard Shaw is quoted as saying, life is no brief candle to me. It is sort of a splendid torch which I have got a hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. And as legislators, you have a unique responsibility and a unique vision. And the vision is looking out at alcohol and other drug addicted individuals and saying, is there a better way in the state of Minnesota? Well, the state of Minnesota can say, yes, we can address funding in an area which we feel we can receive a long-term benefit for. And that long-term benefit is just what I've gone through. It takes time. You know, these aren't Carnac moments where you can say someone's going to be healed for life. But without this type of program, I've seen it as a judge over and over and over again. And any of my colleagues in the room will tell you the same thing. We're just in a continuous cycle. We have to stop it. And I'm a recent grandfather as of Tuesday of last week, a new one. And when I look at my granddaughter coming into this world, and I look at the tremendous taxes on our health system, on our correction system, on our child protection systems, I want a better world for her. And I hope that we can be in a position where, as judges, we continue to work with these type of programs to get the most benefits for the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judge Rancourt. Who is next?
You want to wait for questions, Mr. Chair?
Do you mind if we let's have the whole panel complete, and then we'll open it up.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bonnie Vader, and I'm an educator in the Chisago Lake School District. I'm the program coordinator for a Level 4 program as well as a recovery school in Chisago County. And he's a tough act to follow. As I was preparing and thinking about what I was going to say today, I struggled to land on what I could possibly say in 3 minutes that would have an impact. convincing you as powerful decision makers that this process, drug court process, is not only a good and right thing to do, but is economically probably more efficient than perhaps constructing jails. I wondered if I could just tell you that I've spent 30 years, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, working with young people, and this is key, that were identified with at-risk behaviors, or EBD, if you will, emotionally disturbed and behaviorally disordered. That makes me a kind of a unique person, because the life expectancy of somebody working in this field is 3 years. So I have been 30 years in the making, if you will. I wondered if I could just tell you that I've been taught by the best young people with at-risk behaviors in 3 states. And best thing that they have taught me is the greatest gift we can give them is consistency, structure, empathy, and accountability. They want it, even though they can't say it. As a career, my career comes to a close, and it has been filled with scientific research-based strategies, some of the best in the nation. It's been filled with sad stories, some of the worst over 30 years. Sometimes frightening encounters, rich beyond belief successes, and people who have done what is right and good for kids. It's absolutely clear to me, absolutely clear, punishment is not what changes behavior and empowers kids or people to make good choices. Several years ago, some adolescent young men with an extensive criminal history presented to the group of county professionals in Chisago County. And the following is some profound statements that they made, along with a suggestion or two, a recommendation. One young man said, and he repeated this several times, "When I stopped connecting with healthy people, I started connecting with stuff." And the healthy people in his life went away at a very young age. Another young statement that was made was, "When I was using, I knew just exactly how many times I could get caught before I was in serious legal trouble." A commentary that says maybe we needed to change our legal system. And another statement was, "There's nobody in my life that's going to keep me out of trouble, so why not use drugs?" And over 30 years, ladies and gentlemen, I have heard this theme many, many, many times over. The recommendations that came from these young people, and they were very specific and very direct, and didn't have a lot of data, but they had a lot of experience. They said, "When we offend, we need to get into the court a whole lot quicker, so we know that what we're doing is serious. Because delay only contributes to our denial and our minimizing of our behavior." Think about that. They also recommended that they needed to be more personally connected with their community and the school people so that they knew, key, that they belonged. From these recommendations and the increase in the drug use in our community, the realization that if we keep doing what we've been doing, we're going to keep getting what we've been getting. Under Judge Rancourt's leadership, Chisago County started the Juvenile Substance Abuse Drug Court, commonly known to us as JSAC. The team was put together. It was multiple agencies working together, communicating on a regular basis and frequent, and the young, which we were providing young people with a strong and unified support, as well as a clear and concise expectations. Behavior lesson number one, give clear expectations up front. These characteristics of the drug court process are important research-based elements necessary to modify and change behavior. Very clear research says this is what it takes to change behavior, and that's what we should be about. From the educational view, this process is incredibly positive, and I can tell you from 30 years' experience and wishing that all the agencies working with kids would collaborate and work together, and now I'm blessed at the end of my career to be a part of this. Young people involved in JSAC believe that the members of JSAC team know all about their negative behaviors. Think about that. So attendance in school increased, work performance improved, personal integrity, their personal integrity heightened, and because they assumed there were no weak links in communication, the weak link in communication is something that young people skillfully use to their advantage over time, and it is not an advantage to the adults and the people trying to guide and direct them. They are skilled at it. Throughout my career, professionals have identified the need for agencies involved with adolescents, and I need to underscore this. We've talked about this for 30 years. The need to work together and support each other in the difficult task of providing accountability and clear expectations to the youth that we work with. This is a long wished for opportunity. And it not only works for our young people, but this is an underscored advantage to the professionals. We also get support, information, and direction from all of the disciplines that we work with on the team. Research has confirmed repeatedly two characteristics that kids need or people need. There's immediate sanctions and rewards and positive adult relationships. A recent graduate in Chicago County Substance Abuse Court stated, if I hadn't been in the court every week, if drug court had lasted only 6 months and not 2 years, I know I wouldn't have graduated on the Be Honor Roll, and this was key. Nor would I be employed right now, nor would I be clean. I'm doing well, and it took way too long to get through drug court, so I'm not going to mess it up now. And perhaps a benefit that we didn't recognize early on, but is now becoming more apparent, is the parental support. Just last week, a father of a drug court participant and this young man had a serious drug issue and continues. He said to me, my wife and I were so fatigued and we had nothing left to give and we had nowhere else to go. We are so thankful for drug court because we are no longer fighting this battle alone. And we are revitalized. Thanks for that. And personally, ladies and gentlemen, I feel so fortunate to be a part of this system. Something that works so effectively for kids, that follows research, and over the 30 years that I've been involved with at-risk kids, I believe in my heart that they want it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vader. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, representatives, good morning. I'm Lynn Schultz, Chicago County Commissioner. Drug court works. That's the phrase I heard at my first drug court training conference. But why does Chicago County's Juvenile Substance Abuse Court work? Because of the coordinated efforts of the judiciary, the prosecution, defense, probation, law enforcement, social services, educators, and other stakeholders. We're all coming together, collaborating. Most importantly, it works because of the commitment of people like my colleagues, Judge Rancourt and Vonnie Vader, and the rest of our drug court team. It is our goal to provide direction and structure in the lives of the young people that come before us. Many lack the tools, the self-esteem, and the support to make life decisions that are better. We give them the mechanisms for the positive change. When people enter the judicial system, be it county, state, or federal, a drain opens on our taxation system and the money begins to trickle away. When the system becomes a revolving door for those individuals, the plug is pulled and the money drains away in full force. Documented results show that no other justice intervention brings as much dramatic response as drug court. Even an outcome of harm reduction improves the quality of life for the individual, the family, and the community. How can we go wrong if we put taxpayer dollars into creating productive individuals that are invested in safer communities? Individuals and families that enter the judicial system with disdain, anger, and a lack of hope learn that our system is not one just of punishment, but one that desires a better life for those that enter it. Our participants learn about many facets of our community. In addition to law enforcement and judicial, they are exposed to community service, county staff, and educators as advocates rather than adversaries. They see a judicial system that supports, reinforces, and gives hope of a more promising future. As a county commissioner, I struggle to meet the needs of my county. And unfortunately, the first area of funding that usually gets cut is the area of preventive programs. Many counties like Chisago, we're wringing our hands, contemplating building new jails and asking, what can we do with all these prisoners? The answer to the question is to prevent them from being prisoners in the first place. Our juvenile drug court has shown me a way to do that with intervention before they've been a drain on the system for years. The fact is, we will pay one way or another at this point in time or in the future. It's a matter of prioritizing when and how we will pay. Economic development is a critical element of property tax relief for residents in Chisago County and Minnesota. Our HRA and EDAs are focusing on a skilled workforce as a means to attract business. But I'm told one of the main problems for employers is to find people that can pass a drug test. And that's just the front end of the relationship between employers and employees. The workforce of our state needs attention. We need to do more to aid recovery, prevent relapse, and reduce recidivism, the repeat offender. To start, we need to recognize and acknowledge that drug courts address this recidivism as a major stumbling block to recovery far more effectively than the traditional legal system. A paradigm shift in thinking is necessary to create productive citizens rather than prisoners. County budgets and taxpayers are screaming for change. The mantra of our JFAC team is, if we keep doing what we keep doing, we're going to keep getting what we keep getting. We are working to do something different. To be sustainable, we need your help. Give drug courts the funding and opportunity to change lives, reduce drug use, and create safer communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. We have two more presenters on the drug court. And then we'll open it up for questions.
Mr. Chair, we have Bob Klein, who is a graduate from the adult drug court in Stearns County, and Jim Backstrom, Dakota County attorney, who is a member of our chemical dependency team task force.
Who's Klein? Ms. Klein?
Good morning, Mr. Chairperson, representatives. My name is Barb Klein, and I entered the Stearns County Drug Court system in September of 2002 and became the first graduate of the same system in December of 2003. I am a drug addict, obviously. My drug of choice would be prescription, narcotic, opiates, or painkillers. I worked as a nurse for close to 20 years, so you can just about imagine how I obtained my drug of choice, illegally. When I entered the Stearns County Drug Court, that was my third time being initiated into community corrections. The first time was also in Stearns County. My sentence was 2 days in the county jail with probation, and I successfully completed that after a year and went on with my life. I was not offered any sort of help as far as chemical dependency. The second time was Wright County, where I spent 4.5 months in the Wright County Jail in Buffalo. It was very easy for me to obtain my drug of choice while in that county jail. It was offered to me almost daily. I relapsed at that time after only 4 months of sobriety. The third time, in 2002, I obtained again my drug of choice illegally and would have been facing a prison sentence. I was at the point personally and with my mental health status where I could not face it one more time. I could not figure out how to break this cycle. I could not put my family through it. And so I attempted suicide. You will find that nurses do realize the most lethal way to be successful with that. I was discovered unresponsive. I was brought to an emergency room where I woke up and was very angry that I did indeed wake up, despite the fact that my family was there. I absolutely lost every ounce of hope that I may have had for living successfully and a sober life. Within a month after that emergency room visit, I was initiated into the drug court system. I heard the term drug court, not really knowing what it meant. And the very first day that I presented to the courthouse, there was a chemical dependency assessment done. I was introduced to the probation officer, to the mental health professionals that are involved with the system, to every member of that drug court system. I had a little glimmer of hope and thought to myself that if these people that were virtual strangers to me were willing to take this leap of faith, then the least I could do was to give it all I got. And that's what I did. Since that point, I voluntarily surrendered my nursing license, realizing that there was no way I could remain sober and practice nursing. Currently, I do hold a professional position in the central Minnesota area. And I've also gotten to the point where my life is at an even keel, and I'm ready to give back to the system that gave me my life back. I am the reason that all of these members of the drug courts throughout the state are here today. Drug court saved my life. I cannot stress that enough. In giving back, I would absolutely love to see other people get the same chance that I was given when I entered the system in 2002. March 6th of this year, I will have 3 full years of sobriety. Another fact that I believed was absolutely impossible when I entered the court systems again. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Klein, for your testimony. Mr. Baxter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm James Baxter, Dakota County Attorney and President-elect of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I'm pleased today to be here with my judicial partners, and this truly is a partnership. If drug courts are going to work, as Commissioner Schultz indicated in her testimony, it does require a strong collaboration between everyone involved in the criminal justice process. And our state's prosecutors are ready to do just that. Now, I have to admit that when I first learned about drug courts a number of years ago, I was somewhat skeptical about what I had heard and as to whether or not this type of a process could actually work. That's a feeling that was held by many prosecutors across our state. But over the last 2 years that I've had an opportunity to be a member of the Minnesota Chemical Dependency Task Force and now the Drug Court Initiative, I've had an opportunity to learn a great deal more about drug courts. And I have become convinced that we are not going to incarcerate our way out of the illegal drug problems that we have in our country and in our state. That's not to say that we shouldn't incarcerate the dangerous drug offenders, the dealers, the offenders who commit violent crimes, the gang members. They do need to be incarcerated. Drug courts are not for everyone. But for the vast majority of the drug abusers that we come into contact with in our criminal justice process, time and time again, individuals like Ms. Klein, I believe drug courts hold great promise and great opportunity to make a difference and save lives, just like the testimonial you just heard. Drug courts involve a significant amount of upfront expense in terms of resources. There are more court hearings involved, but they pay dividends in the long run. It really is truly a novel concept when you think about it. A judge and other criminal justice professionals actually taking the time to talk to an offender to tell the offender that they care about their future and that they understand the chemical addictions or the pressures that the addictions of chemicals places upon them, and that these professionals hope that these offenders will be successful in conquering those addictions, finding a job, getting back to their families. We care about that in the same way that we care about keeping drugs away from our children and keeping our communities safe and free from crime. You know, hope is a fleeting prospect for many of us in our society, even those who don't commit crime. It is virtually non-existent for drug abusers. If we can restore hope to drug offenders, I believe we can start them on a road to recovery with the realization that their actions have not only hurt themselves, but their families and their friends and others in their communities. Drug courts, I believe, can do this more quickly and more effectively than any other approach that I have encountered in my 20 years as the Dakota County Attorney. I've had an opportunity, as I mentioned, over the last 2.5 years to be a part of this task force process. I've toured many drug courts personally, both in our state and across our country. I've had a chance to talk to people who have graduated from drug courts successfully, like Ms. Klein, and it truly is a moving experience. And these are the reasons why I have become convinced that this is an opportunity we can't pass up in our state. It is something we need to work together on, and I think it holds great promise for success. And I'm committed to work on these programs in Dakota County, and I know my colleagues are going to be committed to work on these across our state. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll see if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Representative Haas was first.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to tell people that Stearns County, where I was a county commissioner, one of the 19 of the counties, I was going to tell how successful the program actually is, but our graduate here is certainly telling it better than I can. I do believe I was at your graduation, and that's a key word, graduation. But I think maybe the room was so full that I probably would not even have been noticed at that graduation. Within the testimony today, however, you hear the term drug court is not for everyone. And I know in Stearns County and many of the other courts, they do quite a bit of cherry picking. Is that criteria moved down into riskier people now coming into drug court, or are we still at a very high echelon?
Mr. Backstrom, you want to take a stab at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the success of drug courts will hinge upon, as I said, cooperation and each individual jurisdiction kind of defining for itself, you know, how their programs are going to work, because we're not all the same in the 87 counties of Minnesota, and there will be differences in terms of the approaches taken, and that's a good thing, because I think we can learn from chances to make drug courts even more successful. We can learn from the experiences of courts that look at different populations. I certainly think there are a number of criminals that, as I mentioned, offenders that are serious, violent criminals, offenders involved in the wholesale distribution of illegal drugs, gang members, and the like, those who use guns in the commission of crimes, they belong in prison. And I think they are not individuals who should be accepted into a drug court population. But again, I think the vast majority of the population of drug abusers can benefit greatly from programs of this nature.
Just one last comment,
Representative Hopkins.
One of my earlier experiences, and I had talked about Southside Park and the Boys and Girls Club before all that area got cleaned up, we had 5 members involved in drugs and some shooting and some very dangerous activity. One of those people was chosen to go to drug court, and 4 were sentenced to prison. And those were predictable outcomes. 1 graduated, and 4 are still in the system. So.
Thank you, Representative Hines. Representative Cornish is next.
Mr. Chair and members, before I start on the conservative side of my mantra, I wanted to just tell you that I believe in your program, and I believe in funding it and the good things about it. But one thing I'm kind of tired of is being made to feel guilty as a citizen for other people's problems. I think we need drug court, but I look at it as we need to function to help these people. But we get told that it's our fault because people go to prison, and we get told it's our fault because they come out of prison and they're not brought up to speed. At any point during, and probably for a judge that administers drug court, but at any point during the system, are they looked right in the eye and say, you know, quit whining about what brought you here? A lot of my friends and relatives and people I've known have had, you know, been abused as a child, or, you know, didn't get a job or an education, but they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and were very successful in life, and others, you know, turned to drugs and crime. And so sometime during the system, is there an accountability factor, you know, and not just you're a victim of society, you poor thing, and put you back on the, try to put you back on the road.
Should Rehnquist, do you want to take a respond to that, since it seemed like...
Mr. Chair, what I'm getting at is when I was a jailer, when you'd let people out for chapel, you'd be surprised at how many people all of a sudden got religion. And when you gave when you gave people library privilege, you had prisoners coming out and getting books that couldn't even read. They did it just to get out. So how do you keep people from jerking your chain and getting into the system that shouldn't be? And what's the accountability factor for their own mistakes?
I think it's an excellent question.
Judge Rehnquist.
I'm sorry. That's an excellent question. The different types of drug courts we deal with, of course, are the juvenile drug courts and the adult drug courts and this family drug court. So things happen differently in those courts. With the juvenile drug court, as far as responsibility, we may not use the direct language that you made today. However, the fact is there is responsibility. I think what a lot of people have felt initially about drug courts, even when I got into it, I thought, is this a soft-on-crime approach? You know, are we coddling these individuals? Just to give you some history, when we had someone appear on our juvenile delinquency court before we had a drug court, it would be very rote from the standpoint of how we would handle it to the representative. If it was a delinquency finding, we would give them a disposition, and I would see them. And they go to court services. There was not a lot of intensive supervision that went on, not a lot of immediate consequence. And I would see them later on after they violated it. With the drug court, what happens, particularly with the four phases of the drug court, in the first phase, they're there before a judge every week. If they violate a condition of the drug court, a dirty UA, for example, not turning in homework or truancy in the juvenile courts, they're immediately sanctioned. They'll be sanctioned by either community work service hours, they'll be sanctioned by line of lakes for the juveniles, or they'll be sanctioned in some other way to let them know that this is a serious court. So what happens, for example, we're graduating a drug court participant tomorrow who's been in the program for 2 years. This kid was a hard-nosed young man. The police in the area just about had washed their hands saying he's going to be a future prison resident. There's no question in their mind. This kid went kicking and screaming. In fact, one of the first things was a Christmas Eve day, and I had to send him to Lionel Lakes. And I, you know, as a judge, that wasn't a very good thing to do from the standpoint of how you felt about it. That's what he needed. He had violated, there was immediate sanction. And that's the whole purpose behind the drug court, is immediate sanction. And what you also indicated, Representative, is, you know, we all come from different backgrounds, we all have different problems, and that's the benefit of the drug court, is to try to stop that cycle, to try to put that family, because it's a complete unit, it's not just one person normally. A drug addict will impact the whole family. When I speak throughout the state and I ask people in the audience how many are impacted by alcohol or other drugs in their families or friends, I almost get 100% people raising their hands in some fashion. So what happens with addiction, which is a disease, is it has a direct impact on society as well as that family. And when you talk about responsibility and say, yeah, we come from bad backgrounds, and as County Attorney Baxton has indicated, what we try to do is give them hope. We don't coddle them in any fashion. And as County Attorney Baxton says as well, if in fact in an adult drug court, there's a short fuse from the standpoint of a stay of execution of sentence, where if that person continues to violate, they're going to prison. And that's the bottom line with it. And that's how this is part of the reason I believe this works, is that there's immediate sanctions. And they understand clearly they're not going to get away with it anymore. And that's why law enforcement initially as well was hesitant in our county. And then they started doing knock-in chats, and they started seeing how these kids were progressing. And they're on board now. So it's just a matter of letting them know this is a serious court. However, they do have hope in the end. And we try to connect them with services, employment, school, whatever we can do to make them productive. But there is a big punishment component in drug court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mulray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it would be for County Attorney Backstrom. I understand, and I think we need an awful lot more drug treatment and mental health treatment. It's not just drug treatment. But we've had not a very good experience, at least from what I'm told, by both police and probation officers from Hennepin County's drug court. Now, they're reconstituting it. This time they're actually getting input from probation and from police and things like this, which you would think they would have done in the first place. Neighborhoods are up in arms about our drug court there. It's been so bad. But both of those groups tell me that if you take... And another thing, I completely agree with the judge and the other person that said that you need immediacy. I've talked to a lot of kids who are in problems, and they said that they need to have immediate consequences no matter what. But my concern is, it seems like you're going, if you're getting too much into the drug court way of diversion, if you're going to take away the you might call it the club or whatever, both police and probation tell me you'll lose the power to get the bad drug dealers and the people that are ordering the shooting, things like that, because you won't be able to force the people into rolling over on them at times. So it seems to me that you have to be very careful not to lose that strong influence, you could call it, on the system.
And Mr. Bestrom, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you made some very good points, and I think it all comes down to the fact that you have to have the right people in drug court for the right reasons. Some of the people you're talking about that I think the communities that you represent are concerned about really don't belong in drug court, and that was one of the problems with the Hennepin County model. It just had too wide of a funnel at top. Too many people that should not have been there were allowed to come in, and that's why there was a great deal of skepticism in the law enforcement community and in the county attorney's office and in the communities as well. I think that is going to change from what I've heard. Hennepin County is making some very important changes, and like you say, they're involving all of their partners in making those decisions. So I think that's a good thing, and I think they'll have a much better model once that gets put in place. The focus on drug courts is, yes, it's to help the offender and focus on treatment and give them encouragement, but there's also, as Judge Rancourt says, serious sanctions, graduated sanctions that are going to apply. There's a stay of execution of a sentence hanging over their head. If they don't follow through, you know, they will go to jail or to prison and beyond probation for a significant period of time. So it's a balance, again, and I think it's finding the right people for the right reasons and making it work with the partners.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up.
Representative Mulray.
Just a follow-up. My real question was the last part, which was, shouldn't there be the retained club, to which at least both probation and police tell me is necessary to get them to roll over on serious criminals.
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chair, that is a challenge. Again, it depends on the level of offender that's put into the program. If it's a more serious offender, the program we're setting up in Dakota County, for example, is going to include some first and second degree offenders that would be facing prison sanctions that are nonviolent, again, offenders that aren't using guns and the like. They are going to end up, even after they complete drug court, and it's a three-year process as well, the drug court, so it's just like, well, there's 3 years that there's going to be supervision and monitoring over these offenders very closely. And I think it will even encourage those offenders once they realize the extent of the addictions and the damage on their own life, I believe that it, some of those offenders will want to help the system and help identify others in the community. So I think it really might even encourage more cooperation with the police from the offenders that are involved in the process.
Mr. Backstrom or Mr. Sal, do you know if the is the current funding is this is mostly federal funding for the drug courts, or is it a blend of counties?
Mr. Chair, the a substantial amount of the funding for these startup drug courts, these 19, some of them, most of them, are one-time money, both federal and state. There certainly is addition, and all of these required match money from the county, so there's a blend of that. But they're very significant parts of these courts that have allowed them to operate are from these one-time federal grants. Normally, they have a four-year maximum window, and we have a number of the drug courts, as shown on the slide, that got started just in this current biennium with one-time state appropriation funding.
And Mr. South, so we have 19 operating. You want to expand by 12, that's correct?
That's correct. Four in the first year and eight in the second.
And Mr. South, I, the ones that were initiated in 2005, is there any way that we can measure the success, or is that still, are they still too new for those that were initiated? I'm a big supporter of drug courts, but I share Representative Mullery's concern, having been in the having observed the head of the county drug court. I'd like to be, I think it would be helpful if we knew that the current drug courts that are, that came on board in 2005 and 2006 are operating differently, and that you had some demonstrable outcomes that you could share with the committee.
Well, the one thing, Mr. Chair, I could say is that they are operating differently than the Hennepin model. They follow these 10 key components that are the federal grant requirements. It's the research that we've found about what works in drug courts and for whom and what doesn't. All of those that were under both the state grants as well as the federal grants operate in that fashion. We also are in the process of developing minimum drug court standards that would be adopted by our judicial council that will follow that. So any drug court, including currently operating drug courts, would have to meet those standards. And that indeed is what the Hennepin County Reorganized Drug Court is doing. It is taking that research that we now know what works and applying that and reducing the number substantially by, I think, three-quarters of those that are actually going through drug courts. So you'll see a much different drug court model in Hennepin County. With respect to those that are just got started, the problem is, you know, there's a ramp-up time. It takes 12 months, 18 months, in some cases 3 years for these folks to get through the drug court model. And then, of course, you want a year or two at least out in terms of the recidivism issue. Are they rearrested? Are they staying sober and so forth? Recidivism is our measure of success. It is not lowered use. It is recidivism, and that is rearrest. So we are looking at that. We have some promising results from both the Ramsey juvenile and adult courts that got started a little bit earlier. But we don't have any evaluation information yet coming out of these brand new courts. We are evaluating them, however, and all of the research that we've seen around the country, as well as this promising result from our, or I think, says to us that we really ought to be supporting those that are already underway. Because if we don't have this funding, we fear that we will lose those that are already underway, let alone move forward with additional drug courts.
Mr. South, if you could provide the committee, then, if we can't evaluate the ones that were initiated in 05, seems to me you should be able to provide some data on the ones that were initiated in 2002. That would be Ramsey, St. Louis, Stearns, and Dodge. If you could just get some preliminary information on those. And then also, if it would be possible, if we were to fund your request in total, the 19 current and the 12 expanded drug courts, what savings could the criminal justice system or social service providers realize? I realize that's somewhat conjecture, and you're going to have to project here, but it seems to me we should know what savings 5 years down the line we might realize for the investment. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dozal, I think you're the one that has to answer this question. First off, as a Pennington County attorney, in my past life, I'm a great fan of the drug courts. But my specific question is, how do you see it being put into place in greater Minnesota, specifically where you're spread out, like up in my district, my judicial?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olin, as you can see this on the slide here, in this current year, $200,000 was appropriated for pilot testing multi-county drug courts. We agree with you that and one of our purposes is to bring drug courts or drug court strategies throughout the state as a matter of equal treatment, so that every offender, no matter where they live, is going to have an opportunity, the same kind of opportunity. We now have currently operating three-county, multi-county drug courts that have just gotten started in the 5th Judicial District area. And it is our hope by having multiple counties collaborate that we can build the number of cases and therefore, as a matter of cost feasibility, spread the overhead cost of a drug court over more people than that otherwise would be the case. So when we're talking about wanting to expand to 12 additional courts, so there might not be 12 counties, it might be many more. Obviously, we have something like 70 counties that are low-volume counties. So if this works, and so far they're up and operating, they have been able, as I understand, to come to agreement about this. And you're talking about, you know, three independently elected county attorneys, three different county boards, three different probation systems. So this is not easy. But collaboration has been the name of the game and what absolutely is at the heart of these drug courts and why they're different than the traditional approach. So we are working on that. As we go through the session, we can tell you more about how that's working, but that is certainly our hope for the future, and how we, in a cost-feasible way, can bring this throughout the state.
Representative Olin. Representative Hillstrom, and then I just wanted to also make a note to the committee that we are planning to Thursday. We have three presentations that certainly relate to this on substance abuse and DWIs. We'll have Carol Polkowski from the Hazleton Foundation, Professor Simon, who's the Minnesota expert on DWIs, and Judge Jim Den, who has also been very innovative from the bench in dealing with substance abuser. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. My question really is about the impact that these drug courts are having on the children and child protection. And do you find now that you're having families more stable faster, or do you find that because people can fail for a much longer time and they have much more chances that you end up removing children later, or how is that kind of working together?
Mr. Soss.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, we have only what we call family dependency courts, where we've extended drug courts to the child protection area, and there are only two, one of which is in Dakota County that has just gotten started, as I understand. And maybe, I don't know if Jim, or I know that Judge Ed Lynch is in the audience here, might speak to those issues. But we just are beginning in that area in terms of family dependency. We think this is a fabulous area, too, where these drug court principles can be applied. It's a matter of, you know, how much can we take on at one time?
Judge, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, my name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in Dakota County, and I'm the presiding judge in the Family Dependency Treatment Court. It started operation in July. I think we have about 8 families in it now. And it's very early to give you any positive outcomes. However, the preliminary data indicates that we are getting families reunited quicker. We're getting families where the placement, out-of-home placement, in sooner than we have in the traditional approach. So we're hopeful that this will make a difference, and we certainly see the need for this type of an approach because of the extensive amount of meth involving younger adults that had younger children. We have very short timelines, as you probably know, with respect to young children. We're supposed to have permanency decisions within 6 months. We can extend them to 12 months. But within those timelines, we've been able to make some, I think, marked changes in the ability of these families to be reunited.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland, and then if members, we should move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is related a little bit to what Representative Hilstrom was talking about, but I'm thinking of it more in terms of a bigger picture of capacity. What kind of capacity do drug courts have, relative to the need that's out there? I think give us a perspective. How many graduates have we had in the programs that have existed long enough so that they can have graduates, and where are we kind of in that process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, drug courts are at the moment are relatively small in number. Ramsey County has, in its adult substance abuse court, has about 200 participants since its beginning, and they have graduated 55 people so far. In terms of effectiveness, their program retention rate is 83%. Eight drug-free babies who were born as a result of this, and they think about $500,000 in jail bed time avoided. So just to give you some idea, Hennepin County, under its larger program, like 1,400 a year, is now down to about 400 is what they think that they're going to be taking per year. So, you know, as when you say 80% of criminal cases involve AOD, we're probably not reaching a lot, but then again, there is this issue of who are the right people to go into drug court. And we're now finding that it should be both high risk for criminality and addicted individuals, and both of those. That there are other ways to treat some of the other, you know, court trials of offenders that are coming through. But we started small, in part because of the resources that we have available. We could scale up if we had more resources, but then again, we want to make sure that we are only having people in drug court that are the right folks. So we're in the experimental stage, as we said. We've only had 2 years under our belt. As County Attorney Baxter indicated, what goes into drug courts is a collaboration. What the eligibility is a collaboration. We're finding as we go on with drug courts, as the stakeholders see the success, that I think that county attorneys in particular are willing to expand who it is that would go into those drug courts. But then there's an issue of resources, of course.
And I guess maybe this goes to Representative Paylor's question. It would be interesting to see the relationship of the revenue that goes into this component of our judicial budget and how that's going to affect revenue that's going to other revenue that's going into the judicial budget. Is there an offset? Are we going to be saving money so that we can spend less here if we spend more here? I think that relationship ultimately is going to become very important.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, I don't think there would be savings to the judicial budget, but what we think there's savings is to counties for bed avoidance, for recidivism, law enforcement, and then on the other side, prison bed avoidance ultimately. And the hope is, of course, is that not only are you stopping the recidivism for this individual, but intergenerational. I mean, our judges are seeing grandchildren of children they had when they started. I mean, this is what is the saddest thing about this and why so many of them want to make a difference and do something different than we've always done.
All right, Representative Dominguez, I'm going to give you the last question because we need to move on to finish the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I just have one quick question as far as the drug court. I see what you're requesting, but what's the amount in the court itself to prosecute somebody in a drug court or somebody that's reoffending? How much? What's the cost of them to go to court?
Mr. Saul, I don't know if you want to maybe provide that information.
I don't know that I know that, but later, we can try and get you some more information about that.
We'll get that information, Representative Dominguez. Okay, Mr. Saul, thank you everyone for your testimony. It was very, very helpful to the committee.
And Mr. Saul, I don't want you to rush through the rest of the budget, so take as much time as you need. We have tomorrow locked off mostly for you. So, because you have some, you know, some other parts of your budget that are important for you to describe.
Thank you. It's taken a little longer than we had expected for this first part, so I hope you will indulge us. This is the slide is the what we are asking for, and we'll get the information for the chair as he had requested. The second of our initiatives that we're requesting is funding to expand and provide to our citizens statewide basic information on court processes and the court system. Using the Hennepin County Self-Help Center as the hub, we would provide self-help services throughout the state through the web and with a public PC in every court and a helpline back to a call center in Hennepin County for human assistance. So why is it that we need, our citizens need self-help information about the courts? Well, we know that less than 20% of the legal needs of low-income people are met by civil legal services, but it's not just low-income people that need access to information about the courts. It is working people who can't afford lawyers or have a case where it doesn't make financial sense to hire a lawyer. We see self-represented litigants in high numbers in our housing court, our family court, even in divorces with children. These are people who've been told that they need a court order by the police, by a child protection, by a child support office, by banks, by schools. These are grandmothers who are caring for their grandchild and they need a custody order to enroll their grandchild in school or to get medical treatment. They are people who've sold a car and the buyer didn't transfer, register the transfer title, and they're getting parking tickets. People that need to correct birth certificates and on and on and on. And the reason that they need these self-help services is because the law and the case processes are complex and they're difficult to navigate for non-lawyers. And the need for this help, I think, is clear. Hennepin County gets 33,000 walk-in customers every year. Every year it's been in existence, I think, for the last 5 years. That number has increased substantially. The goals for a virtual self-help center are to improve access to courts, to better prepare litigants for hearings in order to reduce dismissals and continuances, which is a frustration for the individual, for the other party, and for the judge, to improve the quality of the information that's going to the judges, and therefore to achieve fair outcomes. Now, the services that we would provide would be general information on all types of cases and proceedings, forms and instructions, video how-to tutorials, hopefully in multiple languages, links to related laws and rules, and then, as I indicated, call center assistance for human assistance. Now, we are asking for what is a relatively modest investment to greatly enhance access to justice for citizens across the state. And this funding would be to provide a public PC in every court, along with two positions in the first year and two more in the second year for that call center assistance in Hennepin County. So we would urge your support of this request.
Questions? Continue.
The second one, or the third one in this area of initiatives, is for a data quality assurance program to support the judicial branch overall performance goals and the integrity of its underlying data. The Judicial Council, as you know, is the new governing body for the judiciary, and it has adopted as six overarching performance goals for the judiciary, one of which is that the judicial branch will ensure the integrity and the accountability of performance by maintaining a record system that is accurate, complete, and timely. Now, valid assessment of court performance and the integrity of the court's electronic record absolutely depend on the accuracy, timeliness, and completeness of data entered on 2 million cases that we handle that flow through the system and are disposed of every year. Now, last spring we brought in a consultant to take a look at our data quality situation, and the consultant found that significant and systemic data quality problems exist, which are caused by disparate business practices from county to county, including variances in our data definitions and data entry errors that are made by our several thousand court employees working in 100 locations across the state. And this is complicated also by integration issues of receiving data from and sending data to other computer systems. All that compromises the integrity of the official court record and the reliability of operational and performance measures reports. So why do we care about this? Well, we care because our new MNSA system, instead of relying on the old paper records that are in the files, the MNSA will be the electronic official record of the court, sending in real time to our justice partners, not just statewide, but nationally, information that affects the lives and liberty, virtually, of people. Now, it's not, for that reason alone, the records need to be accurate, timely, and complete, but we also, as part of the branch, use that information for performance reports and for policy evaluation as well. Now, the fact that we have data quality problems, I think, is not at all surprising for a organization and a case management system as complex and complicated as ours. And let me underscore that this is not just the complexity of the computer system, but the complexity of the underlying substantive and procedural law which is represented by this data. So any large public or private sector organization should have, and must have, a robust data quality assurance program, and that's what is what we are requesting today. In the world of today's world of instant communication, with data harvesters and public safety and privacy issues, data quality assurance is absolutely essential. And this is why we're asking for about $484,000 each year to establish a data quality assurance program at the state level that would provide for some staff and data management tools and training. It also would include some funding for ongoing or a case-by-case data entry identification, error identification, and a correction effort that would go on at all of our trial courts.
Representative Coles has a question about this.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Sal, the very last point you raised, that was kind of the question I wanted you to talk about a little bit. Can you just a little bit more on the data entry error remediation efforts that you're proposing to undertake? I want to understand that a little better.
Well, the problem, obviously, is I was just told yesterday that if, just to give you some notion of the size of this overall issue that we're dealing with, is that if you took every city and county white pages in the country and you added up all of the characters in the names and addresses and telephone numbers, it would be something like 5 billion characters. Our computer system, MNSIS, holds something like 300 billion characters. So you can just imagine all the data entry issues that would relate just to that alone. But then in addition, we are complicated, as I said, with we until recently, we were not a unified system. We had 87 different counties doing things in a different way, different business practices. How Kuching does something different than Hennepin. This affects the way in which data gets entered. So it is very important as I said, because of this instant communication, we're pushing out data, real-time data that's happening now. Convictions and so forth are going to our state criminal history system and to law enforcement throughout the state and even nationally, that we have a very robust program that is concerned about this. So we need at the state level to be dealing with these different business practices, providing training. At the local level, we provide reports, and we're going to be providing more tools to allow them to understand when it looks like there are data errors and then to do something about that to correct those. And that's what we're talking about in this request.
Please continue.
All right. Moving on now to the second large category of requests. These are constitutionally and statutorily mandated services that we have no choice about providing. These are requests are the direct result of workload growth and increased cost in these four areas. We're going to start first with our guardian ad litem request. As many of the committee know, children's justice has been a strategic focus area for the judicial branch since 2000. And we are here asking for guardian ad litem funds, we call them GALs, because it is not rocket science to understand that if we don't effectively deal with children early on, with high probability, child victims will become and may become victimizers in the future, for which society is going to pay over and over again. Now, the importance of guardians ad litem has long been understood. In 1974, the federal government mandated the appointment of a guardian ad litem in every juvenile court case in which abuse or neglect was alleged, and it made that a condition of foster care money to the states. A year later, we passed our own parallel statute, which extended guardian ad litem appointments to family cases as well, where abuse and neglect are alleged. And until recently, the funding responsibility for guardians ad litem rested with the counties, and there has been substantial disparity in the coverage and the quality of these services as a result of that. Now, a guardian ad litem is a advocate for the best interest of the child, and whose duties include conducting an independent investigation to determine the facts relevant to the entire situation of the child and the family, with broad information gathering responsibilities, including and also advocating for the child's best interest, which would include community services where appropriate, and then presenting a written report on the child's best interest with recommendations to the court in these various case types. Now, since 2004, the number of maltreated children served has increased every year. From about 11,000 in 2004 to a little over 14,000 we project in 2007. Now, no new money has been provided for the guardian ad litem program since 2003, but we've seen, as you can see on this slide, a 27% increase in the demand. And just to give you an insight in terms of the importance of guardians ad litem to these CHIPS kids, I like to call on Ed Cassidy, who is a volunteer guardian ad litem in Ramsey County.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Cassidy. I live in St. Paul. I'm an attorney in private practice in our firm's St. Paul office. I'm a citizen representative also on the Community Corrections Board in Ramsey County. I'm the current chair. I've been a volunteer guardian ad litem for about 6 years. I became interested in it when former Justice Blatts, asked practicing lawyers to consider becoming a guardian. In June of 2001, less than a mile from here, members of the St. Paul Police Force, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, DEA, raided a house, arrested 8 or 9 individuals, including a young woman, It took out a cache of weapons, AK-47s that were automatic, a bushel basket full of 9mm, two pit bulls were killed on the site. They found three children in the back room, cowering, and the windows had been darkened. They were emaciated. JC was 3, DS was 5, DS the older was 6. He put them in the back of a police car. The police report later described them as catatonic. The emergency foster mother described them as catatonic. They moved into a foster home in White Bear Lake in July of 2001. CHIP proceeding was started. I was appointed their guardian about the time they moved into the foster home. The mother was given a case plan. She did not have criminal charges as a result of the drug raid. She had other pending criminal charges in Washington County. The mother's case plan never worked out. She could not get in front of her drug problem. In the meantime, the three children began to flourish at the foster home. The foster mother had 8 of her own adult children that lived nearby, dozens of grandchildren, cousins, nieces, and nephews. They started visiting with these children. When I first started seeing the children in July of 01, they would sit on the couch like three little ducks and look at their feet. Within about 6 months, they were running around the house like normal children, except when their mother showed up, or more commonly, didn't show up. They'd throw them into a tailspin that lasts for a few days. As mother was failing on her case plan, she also disappeared for months on end. A petition to terminate parental rights was filed eventually. That case was set for trial in October of 02, about a year and a half after the children were taken out of this drug house. The mother eventually voluntarily gave up her rights. The maternal grandmother and maternal aunt showed up at that termination hearing. Now, as it turns out, they had been contacted in June of 01 and asked if they wanted to take the children. They said no. Once the children were transferred to the guardianship unit, I stayed on as their guardian. Now, at this point, I'm the only adult in their life that has been with them from the jump, except for the foster mother. The guardianship worker, along with me, recommended to the district court that the children be adopted by a couple from the metropolitan area because by this time they'd become bonded with the foster mother. But I thought it was in their best interest to stay, to maintain a relationship with this home, because the children, again, were doing well. They found a family like that. In the meantime, the family from Chicago said that they were interested. I thought that was odd because it was the first interest they'd expressed. I looked into the matter. The first thing I did was called the mother's probation officer and said, where's so-and-so? She moved her probation to Chicago. What address did she give? Her mother's. Relatively clear to me what was going on here. I brought a motion through my lawyer, provided to the guardian office, Mr. Bergstrom, an expert in these matters. We brought a motion in August 03 to order Ramsey County to place these children with this family from the metropolitan area. As the court was considering that, the family, the adoptive family, backed out. I amended our motion to say find another family. In the meantime, the family from Chicago filed an adoption petition, which I disagreed with. Ramsey County Court ultimately agreed with the guardian that the children should be adopted locally, that the family was not in the children's best interest to go with the family. The family appealed that to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Their 15-page decision came out in September 04. The Supreme Court affirmed that. In December 04, they were adopted. In February 05, the local family, I'm happy to say they're doing just fine. The success in that case, my success as a guardian, by the way, is not unique. What's unusual about this case is the extent of litigation, but the role of the guardian is critical because the guardian stays with the case from the beginning until the end, and that's not true about other people in the system. I also had the benefit of a lot of training, expert legal advice provided by the guardian program, and a supervisor in the guardian program that I was able to consult with on a regular basis. You heard eloquent testimony from Judge Rancourt and others about the cycle of violence and drugs and incarceration that they deal with and that the drug courts are trying to stem. I can tell you, as my role in the corrections board, that's undoubtedly true. They can do that. They can stop that cycle. I've seen it done. Another way to stop the cycle is to stop it before it starts. And I can guarantee you that if the system hadn't intervened with DS, DS, and JC, and hadn't intervened successfully, and they would not have intervened successfully without a guardian, the chances of those three children ending up in the juvenile justice system approach 100%. They've got something that they have never had before, a chance. And by the way, what I'm describing happens every day in our juvenile courts because of the guardians. And I can't think of a better investment to stop that cycle than to fully fund this program.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy, for your testimony. I'm afraid we're out of time, but can we take up the guardian ad litem tomorrow morning? I suspect there's some questions by members. If there's no other business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.